Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 128, Cool and Refreshing. Sunday, July 17th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode features the following segments: The Back Porch, Ever-Expanding Skill Set, and Off the Shelf. It's a hazy, hot, and humid morning here in Delaware Water Gap, Pennsylvania, and the past few days have been just the type of days where all I want to do is relax on the porch with some spinning and a cold, refreshing drink. So I'll tell you a little bit about my progress in that direction during this episode. On the back porch is Geyser Stretch, a shawl designed by Stephen West. This is a worsted weight shawl I knit on US size 7 needles using some beautiful kettle-dyed Romney Wensleydale blend yarn from Foster Sheep Farm. I selected analogous colors for this shawl, and even though the pattern calls for colors A, B, and C, I used the same color for A and C in this pattern. Since I was using slightly smaller needles than called for in the pattern, and I was doing that because I thought that the fabric I was getting with the US size 9 was a little bit loose. So I dropped down to a US size 7. And that meant that I was using yarn at a lesser rate than I would have been with the larger needles. So I was able to do another 2 repeats of the stripe pattern. And then I did fewer repeats of the garter stitch border of this shawl. It's very big and quite heavy because it uses nearly 3 skeins of worsted weight yarn. And so it was difficult to think about how to block this shawl. And I wanted to preserve the shape of it. There are increases throughout the shawl that create a spiraling kind of shape. It's heavy enough that I didn't think I would need to use pins or blocking wires or anything like that. And so what I eventually decided to do was just to wrap the shawl in a spiral and let it lie flat to dry. And I pulled some of the increase rows into subtle points as I did that. And it dried quite quickly considering the humidity that we've had. And I really like the effect. I think this is going to be a great gift, and I think it will be a shawl as well as kind of a lap blanket, something great to have in your car during the winter months, just as an insurance policy against any extra cold, even though it's very difficult to think about those kind of temperatures considering our recent weather. I put a photograph in the show notes showing how I blocked the shawl in a spiral so that you can see that if you're interested. The completion of this Geyser Stretch shawl brought me an additional 683 yards toward my stash goal of 5,000 yards. And that makes my completed project so far this summer a total 2,317 yards. So I'm about halfway to my goal, and I have quite a few other projects underway, including the spinning of Three Waters Farm June Greens fiber. This is a 60-40 wool silk blend in lovely greens and gold greens. Last evening, I sat under lamplight with a cool, refreshing drink and completed the spinning of my singles for this project. So even though today is a challenge day, it will be a kind of a rest day for me while I allow those singles to rest for 24 hours before I start plying them. And I will be creating a 2-ply yarn. I think it will be a fingering weight yarn. And I'm really curious to see how this kind of tonal quality of the yarn spins up as I ply it. I also completed one of the Agatha socks. I'm knitting a pair of Agatha socks, a beautiful pattern design by Claire of New Hampshire Knits. And I had mentioned in a previous episode that I had completed the sock, but I had declined to Kitchener it closed because I wanted to check my mom's foot size. She tried the sock on this past week. She said it was perfect. She's like, yep, I think you should close it right here. This feels great. She thought it was so pretty, the design. And this is before I had washed or blocked the sock. So I think it's going to look really exceptionally pretty once I give them a good soak. So in keeping with the challenge from Ellen of the Twin Set Designs podcast, I wanted to work from memory to Kitchener the sock toe closed. But I also wanted to avoid the donkey ears situation that I typically get when I use a Kitchener stitch at the end of the toe, that there's sort of these pointy ears on either side of the closure. So I remembered a podcast episode from Paula of the Knitting Pipeline where she talked about a tip to avoid those donkey ears, which involved slipping a stitch and looping it over the next stitch on the needle at either end of the sock. So I tried that, and then as I was about to Kitchener close the last few stitches, I realized that there had been different numbers of stitches on my needles the whole time I was closing the sock. And I thought I had even numbers of stitches on my needles and that I had been doing even decreases following the pattern directions. But somehow I had 18 stitches on the top of the sock and 16 on the bottom. And I'm not sure how that happened. So it took me a few tries to figure out how to resolve the conflict. And also, I didn't care for the way that slipping one stitch and looping it over looked on the toe of the sock. It did prevent the donkey ear situation, but I could see where this slipped stitch was, and I didn't like that look. So eventually what I decided to do, since I had this uneven number of stitches on my needles, was to treat the first two and the last two stitches on my front needle, the top of the sock, as one stitch. And so the Kitchener stitch requires you to purl the first stitch, leave it on the needle, knit the second stitch, leave that stitch on the needle, and then start Kitchenering, where you actually bind off a stitch in each step of the Kitchener. And so I just treated those first two stitches on the front needle as one stitch, and then I treated the last two stitches on that front needle as one stitch. This solved my problem of having different numbers of stitches on the needles. It solved the donkey ears problem of having something that stuck up, and it kept a really smooth look to the Kitchener close of the sock. I'm not exactly sure why I had different numbers. The patterning on the front of the sock looks perfect. So it may be that I had some differing numbers of stitches all along and just didn't realize it. I'm not a very experienced sock knitter. And I'm not sure if I will be repeating that mistake on the second sock. But I think just with two stitches, it's probably not going to make a real difference in the fit of the sock. Hopefully not a noticeable difference. So I am working my way down the leg of the second Agatha sock, and the knitting of the second sock is proving to be much easier and more intuitive than the first time around. I'm not sure why, but I was following the written directions on the first sock, and this time I'm looking at the chart for the sock pattern, and it's much more intuitive for me. So that's going well, and I'm looking forward to completing those socks and adding that yardage to my stash dash totals. I've been working to expand my repertoire of produce-inspired drinks this summer. And one of the things that was suggested to me by listener Fernie from Minneapolis is to make some switchel. I guess she has listened to the podcast enough to know that I enjoy tart and kind of unusual drinks and that I'm a big fan of ginger. So she suggested this drink that has quite a long history as something refreshing, especially for field workers. It involves cider vinegar, ginger, maple syrup, and then usually something to water it down. It could be water, club soda. I've been using seltzer. So I found a recipe for switchel that assumed the cook would have a juicer, and I do not. My fix or workaround for this is that I grated ginger and then blended all of the ingredients in my blender at a very high speed and then poured the mixture through a very fine mesh strainer and discarded all of the ginger pulp. And I think what this allowed to do is extract all the juice and the flavor from the ginger and discard the fibrous bits. The switchel is very highly flavored, very tart. It's kind of astringent, and it's been really refreshing to serve that with seltzer water and lime, and I've also put some mint leaves into the drink. I was enjoying that last evening on the porch while I was spinning, and for Samuel, I made a version of a mule. I call them ginger mint mules, and I've been using some really excellent bourbon whiskey. It's called Smuggler's Notch bourbon whiskey that I purchased on my recent Vermont trip. So I use a shot of that, several tablespoons of ginger syrup. And this is something I make all summer long. Whenever I peel ginger for a recipe, I reserve the ginger peels and just put them in a small storage bag in the freezer. And then when I've accumulated, between a third of a cup to a half of a cup of this, then I add 1 cup sugar to 1 cup water, bring that to a boil, put all of those ginger shavings into the pot, let it simmer for just a few minutes and then remove it from the heat and let it steep for 12 to 24 hours. I strain that off and keep it in a mason jar in the refrigerator. And then I just have that available whenever I'm making mixed drinks. So for the mule, a shot of bourbon whiskey, several tablespoons of the ginger syrup, and then I use lime wedges and mint, and then fill to the top with ice and seltzer. That's also a delicious and refreshing drink. I thought that I would be making some whiskey peach schnapps this week with a recipe from Taproot Magazine, But I did not get to that with my peaches because we were invited to join some friends for dinner. And in a recent edition of Cook's Country magazine, this is put out by Cook's Illustrated, they had a recipe for skillet peach upside down cake. And since I had volunteered to make dessert, I thought this would be quick and easy and delicious. And it was a very good recipe. The basics for any kind of skillet upside down cake are similar. You have some sort of sugar and butter in the bottom of the pan, and then you arrange fruit slices. Then you make a relatively quick batter, pour that over top, and bake it in the oven. And then you invert the cake to serve. So you get your beautiful fruit, in this case, beautifully arranged spirals of peach slices on the top when you serve. And it's very nice with whipped cream or ice cream or even just on its own. And it also does very well for breakfast or brunch with coffee. Cook's Illustrated is very proprietary about their recipes, so I was not able to find this particular recipe online. However, if I were to make a peach skillet cake again, I think that I would follow the Food 52 recipe for the ginger rhubarb downside up cake, because that has oatmeal in the batter and it's just a really moist, delicious cake. I also think that the combination of ginger and peach is magnificent, so I would like to try that combination. Cook's Illustrated recipes are very well tested, and I usually don't find any fault with them, and I think this is fine, but I really do think that oatmeal cake is better quality. I will link to that recipe for the rhubarb ginger cake. I talked about it in a much earlier episode. Another recipe I tried this past week was the warm wax bean salad with a bacon vinaigrette. And this is a very simple, very tasty dish. I made it into a main course by serving the beans over a big bed of salad greens. And then I had some other leftover vegetables from previous meals. So I kind of made an arranged salad on the plate. I had some green salad, some leftover potato salad, and some just diced cucumbers and tomatoes and a little bit of vinegar and oil. So all of those kind of created this composed salad on the plate. To make the warm wax bean salad, I think one of the keys to the dish is not to overcook the wax beans. So I just steamed them slightly and removed them from the heat and drained them before I thought they were really done. I just set them to the side while I prepared the remaining elements to the dish. This involved sautéing some diced bacon slices and then removing the bacon when it was done with a slotted spoon, using that fat to sauté some very thinly sliced onion and some halved grape tomatoes or some diced tomato in the pan. Then I add the beans back in just to keep them warm. And I served it over salad greens with the bacon, of course, and then some chopped basil and parsley. It's just a very tasty, very satisfying dish. As a finishing touch, I just splashed a little bit of flavored vinegar over the top to create the vinaigrette. I think the recipe calls for sherry vinegar, which I don't have on hand, but as a Christmas gift, I was given some really delicious ginger vinegar. It's sort of thick and syrupy, so just a little bit goes a long way. And I'm really a fan of that wax beans with bacon vinaigrette. So I think that might be part of the summer rotation as long as I can find them in the market. Over the past few weeks, Samuel and I have really been honing our ever-expanding skill set by creating a pantry in a very awkward, unused space in our kitchen. Our kitchen space is quite small and compact, and though it's in our future plans to do a kitchen remodel, I don't want to spare any expense on materials or appliances when I eventually do that. So the work we have done is just to make the space more usable and to create some storage options that will not be redone in a future remodel. So we're really trying to use our energy, our money, and our resources very wisely. I've mentioned in the past my extreme appreciation for my Blomberg refrigerator. And we had a very traditional space for an American-sized refrigerator in the kitchen. And when we bought the Blomberg refrigerator, we framed out that refrigerator space and created more shelving options because this European model doesn't take up that much room. To the left of the refrigerator, there was a very deep but not very wide space, and we had used it as kind of a broom closet. We installed a few shelves back there, but it was very difficult to use, and it was clear just looking at it that there was a lot of unused space in that compartment. It didn't have a door, and we knew that wasn't the end result of what we wanted. It was just like a temporary fix. So we came across the idea of installing a shelving unit that slides on a mechanism out, completely out into the room, and then stores back into the wall. These are very expensive to order ready-made. And so Samuel ordered the mechanism. It's a bottom rail and a top guide. And then he took all of the measurements and purchased supplies to create the shelf. And then we would install it ourselves. This was successful in the end, but it was very challenging because the mechanism had directions that were primarily in German. So there would be a paragraph of German and then a sentence of English. So you could tell that there was crucial information that was missing. And even though the mechanism itself was very heavy duty, you could tell it was very well made. The drawings and sketches in the directions were very odd looking, and they weren't to scale. They didn't make a whole lot of sense. Everything in the directions made sense retroactively. As you completed a step and then you looked back at the directions, you thought, oh, right, that's how it goes. And it was the kind of situation where we really needed to make the entire thing and then install it before we could figure out whether or not it would work. And there were a few dicey moments, but we eventually did install this pantry, and it added about 8 cubic feet of storage space to the kitchen, which is extremely exciting to me. The glide on this pantry is really excellent, and the shelving is just the way we wanted it because we took measurements of the kinds of things that we would store. Lots of things that were sitting out are now out of sight. And then with the additional storage space I have in my kitchen, this will allow me to bring some preserved, jarred, and canned items that I had been storing in my basement up to the kitchen. It wasn't the optimal way to store preserved and canned goods because the basement is damp and unfinished, and I just didn't really like having those things down there. So it's an exciting expansion to the kitchen, and I will link to the Instagram video that Samuel took after I completely filled the pantry shelves. Off the shelf. I've been enjoying Around the World in Six Glasses as part of the reading for the Eat Your Words read along this summer, and I'm up to chapter 3, which is about spirits. This reading has partially influenced my interest in making cool and refreshing drinks with farm fresh produce, but I've also enjoyed the review of history provided in this book. And in the case of spirits, the author makes mention of the colonists to the New World and their increasing frustration with the availability of wine and beer that they were used to drinking because they really didn't have those products and they couldn't find the ingredients or have the skill and wherewithal to create them to their own satisfaction in the New World. This put them at the mercy of ordering very expensive European products. And even if they had the money to buy them, what would often happen in the ship coming over is that the crew would drink most of the beer that they had on board. So there wasn't very much left to deliver when they got to the New World. And so part of the strength of the colonies was to create some system for either making or importing alcoholic beverages that were satisfying to them and that met the needs of their budget and their politics. I will share what I think is a pretty engaging passage from this text. Eventually, the Virginia colonists decided to concentrate on the commercial cultivation of tobacco and to import malted barley from which to make beer from Europe, along with wine and brandy. Everything changed in the second half of the 17th century, however, when rum became available. It was far cheaper than brandy since it was made from leftover molasses rather than expensive wine and did not have to be shipped across the Atlantic. As well as being cheaper, rum was stronger, too. Rum quickly established itself as the North American colonists' favorite drink. It alleviated hardship, provided a liquid form of central heating in the harsh winters, and conveniently reduced the colonists' dependence on imports from Europe. Rum was generally drunk neat by the poor and by the better off in the form of punch, a mixture of spirits, sugar, water, lemon juice, and spices, served in an elaborately decorated bowl. This drink, like the cruder navel drink of grog, was a forerunner of the modern cocktail. And then I'll share what I think is the thesis of this particular chapter. One of the things I enjoy about this text is there's very detailed information about the drinks themselves, but then the author steps back and talks about the context of the beverage in the course of history. Unlike beer, which was usually produced and consumed locally, and wine, which was usually made and traded within a specific region, rum was the result of the convergence of materials, people, and technologies from around the world, and the product of several intersecting historical forces. Sugar, which originated in Polynesia, had been introduced to Europe by the Arabs, taken to the Americas by Columbus, and cultivated by slaves from Africa. Rum distilled from its waste products was consumed by European colonists and by their slaves in the New World. It was a drink that owed its existence to the buccaneering enterprise of the Age of Exploration, but it would not have existed without the cruelty of the slave trade, from which Europeans deliberately averted their gaze for so long. Rum was the liquid embodiment of both the triumph and the oppression of the first era of globalization. The Eat Your Words read-along continues all summer long on the Yarns at Yen Who podcast, and there is a prize for each month. For the month of July, one lucky listener will receive a set of note cards from Joanna of Knit Spin Farm. They have photographs of her very photogenic farm animals on them. And all you need to do to enter is to participate in the Eat Your Words read-along thread. You can comment on the posts of others. You could share some passages or ideas from what you're reading. And I look forward to seeing your participation.
Acorn horns are jobbing off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, a bird out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or following me on social media. Music for today's episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.